This is the Quality News Network. 16 Afghans held by the U.S. that go to Guantanamo Bay have been released and are now back in Afghanistan, where they're telling reporters they were badly treated by the U.S. military during their detention. Many of them had been held for more than 4 years. Another estimated 400 suspected militants, mostly Afghans and Pakistanis, are still jailed at Guantanamo, where the International Red Cross has just visited the 14 al-Qaeda leaders recently transferred there from secret CIA prisons. In Iraq, a gunman stormed a new Baghdad satellite TV station today, killing 11 of the 12 people inside, including the head of the station's board of directors. In addition, the bombs targeted at Iraqi police patrols have killed 8, and another 40 tortured bodies have been dumped throughout the city. The top U.S. commander in Iraq, General George Casey, says he expects sectarian violence to continue, but has no plans to increase U.S. troops in Iraq. A British man has pleaded guilty in London to conspiring to bomb a number of U.S. buildings in New York and Washington, D.C. several years ago. He was arrested before he could carry out his plans. The House Ethics Committee is interviewing witnesses today in connection with the Mark Foley House Page scandal. Among them, one of the three congressional members of the House board that oversees the Page program. She is a member of the Republican Party, and she says GOP leaders hid Foley's inappropriate behavior towards Pages from her. The committee is also hearing from former Foley Chief of Staff Kirk Fordham, who claims he informed the House leadership years ago about Foley, something the House leaders deny. Former Virginia Governor Mark Warner, a Democrat, says he will not be running for president in 2008 after all. Instead, he says he wants to have a real life and not subject his family to the impact of a long campaign. North Korea is threatening Japan with what it describes as strong countermeasures if Tokyo imposes the harsh sanctions it announced yesterday against Pyongyang. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council continues to debate how to respond to North Korea's nuclear weapons tests. Sanctions are being discussed, though China has not agreed to the severe sanctions proposed by the United States. The vote is likely tomorrow. A new political poll in Israel shows that Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's support has plummeted since the Israeli-Hezbollah war, and that his Kadima party would finish in third place were a national election to be held today. Investigators still sifting through the wreckage of a private plane which crashed into a high-rise Upper Manhattan apartment building yesterday, killing the pilot, Yankees pitcher Corey Lytle. Winter has come early to much of the Midwest, where freezing temperatures, snow showers, and icy roads have caused a number of highway accidents. This is the Quality News Network. Science and business are coming up.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
In science news today, a comprehensive government study finds that antipsychotic drugs sometimes used in Alzheimer's patients do very little to help, and sometimes the benefits are canceled out by frequent side effects. Unemployment is higher. The Labor Department reporting that new claims for unemployment benefits rose by 4,000 claims to 308,000 last week. America's trade deficit has hit an all-time high, nearly $70 billion in August. That's up 2.7%. National Association of Realtors says U.S. home sales for the year will be weaker than previously forecast. The association also saying that the median home price is likely to rise only 1.6% for the entire year. McDonald's is forecasting third quarter earnings far above Wall Street expectations, and PepsiCo reports its third quarter profit jumped 71%. Light sweet crude oil is trading this hour at $57.65. That's up 6 cents from yesterday's close. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones again in record territory, hitting a new trading high this morning when it passed 11,900. Right now it is up to 11,920, up 20 points. NASDAQ is up 8, up 18 rather. The NASDAQ is up 8. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. Now 5 past the hour.
And now from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There are all kinds of conspiracy theories that go on the right and the left, and some are true and some aren't. On the right, of course, there's the claim just recently that the Democrats were behind the outing of Mark Foley, that it's their October surprise, and other claims such as that the Clintons killed Vince Foster. On the left, you hear claims that George Bush intentionally caused 9/11, and then you hear also conspiracy theories that have some basis in fact. For example, the connection between Reverend Sun Myung Moon and George H.W. Bush, the current president's father, and North Korea. Or the real damage and real trouble that we have with Diebold election machines, which is that they can be hacked into. So how do you know when a conspiracy theory is accurate and when it's not? When do we give credence to it? And what explains all the people that give credence to theories that have no basis in proof? To try to answer these questions, my guest is Robert Perry. He is an investigative journalist. He investigates a lot of these theories, showing some to be true and some without evidence. And he does Consortium News, and you can find the link to that on my website at RadioInsideScoop.com. Robert Perry, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Let me start with the question of just sort of conspiracy theories in general. What is it that causes people on the right or the left to want to latch on to a belief that there's something going on underneath the surface?
Well, often there is something going on beneath the surface, and I think Americans are aware that what they get on the surface from the media and from government statements, that's not entirely the whole story. So there's reason to be suspicious, especially when events of great magnitude occur, that there probably are factors that we're not being let in on, that there are secret contacts, there are secret agendas. All that is probably true. The tricky point, of course, is when there's actually evidence and when the conspiracy theories are based mostly on conjecture and hypotheses, not on real hard proof.
Well, let's go down sort of conspiracy theory by conspiracy theory. One of the interesting things I found on your website has to do with a fairly old article, but one that I think is definitely timely given the recent North Korean nuclear test, and that is the connections between Reverend Sun Myung Moon, proclaimed Messiah, and the current president's father, George H.W. Bush, and North Korea. Can you tell our listeners about those?
Well, I mean, certainly the whole story of Sun Myung Moon is one that probably we should know more about. Basically, he was a Korean a religious figure, basically a theocrat, a person who believes that that his religion, the Unification Church, should come to dominate the world, not only people's personal religious decisions. That's what he has sort of laid out in his writings and speeches. But he's always had a second side to him. That is, he effectively became an important figure in the world because of his political operations and the money behind them.
Particularly the Washington Times newspaper.
Well, even going back further, he was involved with the Korean CIA, and they helped him to build influence around the world, especially in the United States. They helped him make the connection to move from being a small sect on the Korean peninsula to being a worldwide movement. They put him in touch, for instance, with leaders in Japan, some of whom were involved in the Yakuza organized crime operations, and he tapped into what was first the Asian Anti-Communist League and later became the World League, where a number of unsavory right-wing figures, including World War II, pooled money and brought together resources to help Moon build his movement from a small thing to something that reached to South America, that reached to the United States, that reached to Europe, and of course into Asia. So he had this powerful backing, and that ultimately allowed him to develop useful ties to other intelligence services, including the United States.
Well, and we've talked on the air before in past broadcasts about some of his strange notions, declaring himself the Messiah, talking to Jesus and Hitler, trying to replace crosses on churches with crowns that, in fact, shows that he, I guess, is the supreme leader. In fact, I did a story a year ago. I broke a story about him getting crowned in the Senate. But the specific thing I want to talk about is his connections with the Bushes, either father or son. Can you tell us about those?
Well, right. Well, first of all, remember that when Moon was first being investigated, there was what was called the Kriegate investigation in the late 1970s, and it found these ties between Moon and the Korean CIA and its efforts to build influence in the United States. And then early in the 1980s, he became more politically involved. He set up the Washington Times newspaper, which became essentially a mouthpiece for the Reagan-Bush administration. He promoted their propaganda themes. He attacked their opponents. He tried to undermine folks who got in their way. So he became very useful to Ronald Reagan and to George H.W. Bush, and they returned the favors. I mean, President Reagan described the Washington Times as his favorite newspaper. Later on, when George H.W. Bush became president, he also hailed the Washington Times for its value in promoting his point of view in Washington. In the key 1988 campaign, when George H.W. Bush was running for president, it was the Washington Times that published a bogus story about Michael Dukakis, claiming that Dukakis had undergone psychiatric treatment. I happen to know the reporter who was involved in that story who quit over it because this was a total falsification of what he had developed as information.
And, of course, so you had, Press Secretary Tony Snow is a former Washington Times reporter, or even is an editorial writer.
Right. The Washington Times provided a very important anchor for getting out right-wing or conservative or Republican viewpoints. And it was done in such a way that often it had the look of a disinformation campaign, because often these allegations would turn out to be bogus, but they would get circulated and damage political opponents. So, and that applied not just to people who were like Democrats. It also applied to people like the Iran-Contra special prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, who was a Republican, former Republican judge, who regularly was attacked by the Washington Times, so much so that he wrote about it in his memoirs, Firewall, when he described how the cover-up of Iran-Contra had been kept away from George H.W. Bush in particular.
Robert, so what do we know about exchange of monies between George H.W. Bush and Reverend Sun Yung-moon?
After Bush left the White House in 1993, he effectively went to work for Reverend Moon. He began giving speeches at Moon Organization rallies and meetings in Washington. He gave a number of speeches in Asia, and I think most significantly, he flew down to South America in 1996 when Moon was starting a version of the Washington Times for South America, Tiempos del Mundo, and Bush was brought in to smooth the waters because there were a lot of stories at the time about how Moon was involved with drug traffickers and with death squad operations in Latin America, because he'd been backing many of these military governments that had really terrorized the region. And so Bush goes down to sort of speak for Moon. He calls Moon the man with the vision. And each of these trips, he would pick up sizable payments. I was told by one of Moon's senior lieutenants who had left the church that they had put down $10 million as a line item to pay Bush for his various services.
Now, $10 million.
Right. Bush has never been willing to say how much of that he actually collected, and I can't say for certain exactly how much was actually paid to him, but that was the amount I was told was set aside for handling him. And we now know that was not a particularly large amount as far as Moon's concerned. He pays millions of dollars to world leaders in other places to get influence with their governments as well.
And my understanding is that the Washington Times loses hundreds of millions a year So he puts a lot of money into that. Tell our listeners, if you can, about the connection between Moon and North Korea. I mean, it's interesting. Here he has his connection with the president's father. North Korea is ostensibly our enemy, but Moon has a connection there too, right?
Right. What I was able to discover, I filed some Freedom of Information Act requests back some years ago now, back in the late 1990s or early, maybe around 2000, in that time frame, and the documents were turned over to me. I guess it would have been sometime in 2000. And the and basically what these records were, these were Defense Intelligence Agency documents, and what they showed was that Moon had been funneling money in just basically payments to North Korea's leaders, both the previous president and the current president of North Korea. Both received multi-million dollar payments, according to the DIA, which had been tracking these payments, because at the time, this would have been in the early 1990s when these payments were delivered, at the time the United States was trying to prevent North Korea from having the means to develop its missiles and to develop atomic weapons. So the fact that there was that hard cash was being put into their accounts was not insignificant to the DIA, which is responsible for monitoring threats to U.S. national security.
Robert, what does Moon get for these payments to North Korea? What does he get from North Korea?
Well, he wanted to, and at least on the surface, he wanted to develop a business foothold in North Korea. There, he was born in North Korea, or it's now North Korea. And he wanted to have a large swath of territory, which he would live in as kind of a Vatican, and that's how it was described. That there'd be this sort of extra territorial place where Moon would sort of sit as a pope. Although I think he probably considered himself much higher than the pope, but the
apparently
but he would
Jesus
have that.
Works for him. But go ahead.
Right, exactly. Jesus works for him. So. So that was part of it, but there were also just more business deals. There was a desire to set up or to use a company that Moon was using for manufacturing and sort of getting an inside track. There were also plans for tourism. There were some sites in North Korea that are particularly attractive. They're striking geographical formations and. So Moon
was
trying to.
Did any of this pan out? I mean, the business, the tourism, the money.
Some of it panned out. I mean, some of it didn't. I mean, there are other companies that also were trying to get these contracts from South Korea, and so Moon did not win out on all of them, but he went out on some, and he still has business operations that go into North Korea. The legal question for him, however, is that Moon obtained a green card. He was a resident, a legal resident alien of the United States, and the American laws during this time and subsequently were very strict against doing any kind of business, making any kind of payments to North Korea, because it was considered an enemy state. Those laws apply not only to American citizens but to resident aliens. So there was this issue of that Moon was clearly, at least based on these documents, either violating or skirting at the edge of those laws. When I talked to one of his top lieutenants, Bo Hee Pak, who was then living in Seoul, South Korea, Bo Hee Pak told me that Moon wasn't doing this in his own name, that he was using South Korean companies to handle these business relationships, and that was the argument that supposedly made it not illegal. But the law actually is pretty clear that if an American or an American resident alien has control of a company, that company cannot do business with North Korea. But Moon is so well connected now, especially on the right. He's done so many favors for so many conservatives, many of them now in power in Washington, that he operates almost beyond the law.
The question today, I think, is he still doing those favors? I mean, now we have North Korea that's done a nuclear test. We have Bush going to the United Nations and trying to get sanctions against North Korea. Is his father still connected with Reverend Sun Myung Moon, or has George H.W. Bush cut off some of these ties?
Well, I think since George W. Bush became president, I'm not aware of any public events that George H.W. Bush has conducted for Moon. I can't tell you. Most of this research I was doing was some time ago. I have not really been following that as closely as I did for when I was doing these stories. But I'm not aware at this point of current work that George H.W. Bush is doing for Moon. But as I say, Moon is a person who deals with a number of world leaders, often former world leaders, who will give him and his organization some cachet by having these people show up at his events and give speeches on his behalf. So it's not as unusual as it might appear to some people that you have prominent former statesmen showing up and taking Moon's money and giving speeches on his behalf.
Robert, we're going to talk about a number of conspiracy theories this hour. This one, it seems there's ample evidence for. In fact, I reported on some of this myself a year ago, though you clearly have more information than I do. But one of the things that people use to say that certain theories aren't true is they say, well, where's the mainstream press on this? Why hasn't ABC News reported on what George H.W. Bush has done for Reverend Sun Yung-moon? Why haven't we seen it on CNN or places like that? On this particular story, why do you think the mainstream press hasn't covered it?
Well, you know, as you know, I came from the mainstream press. I was with the Associated Press and Newsweek for a number of years. I've worked for PBS, and I worked for Bloomberg News as an editor on their securities regulation coverage for 4 years in the early 2000 period. So I've sort of seen this from the inside. I mean, in some cases, Moon is sort of an anomaly that is also considered a religious leader. So it's uncomfortable for many editors and journalists to deal with this issue. In the case, say, of the Washington Post, there's the additional problem where they feel if they write about Moon, whenever they do write, and they have done some stories on Moon, they're accused of going after a competitor, the Washington Times.
Okay, but there is the New York Times, and people do talk about religious figures. Certainly the Pope himself has gotten some hot water lately, and Reverend Sun Yung-moon is far less respected than the current Pope. So I don't...
Well, it's a good question. But I think the point, in many cases, editors will find reasons not to, because what people have seen over the years is when they have dealt with Moon, they're heavily attacked. There's kind of that cult mentality that goes through the Moon organization. And so when people have dug into his operation, like, say, Congressman Frazier did during the Koreagate hearings in the late 1970s, they are then subjected to very extensive character assassination. And plus, Moon, because he has spread money around among some of the influential folks on the right, will pull in some very powerful and aggressive political operatives. For instance, Terry Dolan, who was one of the early, you know, conservative attack people in the 1970s, he ran a group called NICPAC, if you remember. He was brought on by a Moon organization and sort of led the assault on Congressman Frazier, and it basically destroyed Frazier's congressional career.
If the Democrats take back the House or even the Senate, one of the things I'll be recommending to my former colleagues on the Hill is that they do further investigation into Reverend Sun Yung-moon and who he gave money to, and they may just do that. We'll find out. We got to take a break. Folks, we're going to talk about other theories. This one is fairly well proven, but there are all kinds of theories that haven't been proven. And Robert Perry is the perfect guy to talk to because he investigates whether these things are true or not. If you want to call in and ask any questions, you're welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, or 877-4-HEAD-ON. We'll be right back right after this.
the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
We look to the day when you can live in freedom, and America and Iran can be good friends and close partners in the cause of peace.
See, this is where we get a really bad reputation. I live in a country where I'm not even sure if my vote's going to count in November. How free are you? How free are the people on the Gulf Coast? How free are the families that still grieve for the bodies dragged out of Aracoma and Sago? How free are they? He throws around precious terms with precious little regard for them. How free are we that chose by a wide margin in the year 2000, November 2000, we chose a man named Al Gore to be the President of the United States? How free are we that we were saddled with this ignorant, ignorant, hateful little man? How free are we? How free? I'm Bob Kincaid. Join me weeknights, 7 to 10 Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path? One that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way? Or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580. Or go to peacecorps.gov.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is Robert Perry, investigative journalist of Consortium News. We all know there's a lot going on beneath the surface when it came to the question of Mark Foley, of course. Everyone in Washington, including myself, knew he was gay and hitting on people, but only a few knew that he was actually hitting on underage people. When it came to the war in Iraq, it was a fairly open secret, at least among the government, that the people in Washington were manipulating intelligence, as they said in the Downing Street memo, fixing the facts around the intelligence, but that didn't really come out until just today. And yet there are all kinds of conspiracy theories that will never have seen the light of day because there's just no evidence to prove them. Everything from the right's claim that the Clintons killed Vince Foster to those on the left that say that Bush actually put those terrorists on the plane and caused 9/11, or that the buildings, some I know say that they weren't destroyed by planes at all, but were destroyed in controlled explosions. I began with something that I thought was fairly easily proved with Robert Perry, the conspiracy theory, if you will, the discussion between Reverend Sun Myung-moon, George H.W. Bush, and North Korea. I want to move to some of the unproven ones and ask Robert how it is that he determines whether something is proven or not. I mean, there are a lot of people on the left that claim that Bush caused 9/11. Have people approached you with that?
Oh, pretty much every day.
Every day?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, you know, the problem I have with that those theories is that there's no real evidence that it happened. There are no people have their opinions, they have their speculation, they cite anomalies, they cite gaps in the official investigation of 9/11. At least what was published in the 9/11 report, but they don't come forward with real evidence that I would consider able, like would, that I could check out. I mean, there's not, for instance, you have to assume that in a case like that there would be people approached if someone's actually pre-wiring, you know, the Twin Towers with explosives. First of all, that's not an easy thing to do. It requires a lot of explosives and a lot of preparation. You know, we're ripping into walls and placing these explosives. And of course, you have people working in those offices every day. But you've had nobody who has come forward and said, gee, you know, I was approached by some folks who wanted me to do this, and I refused. Or, gee, I took part in it, and I regret it. And that's what really happens when you have these kinds of events. And, you know, I've covered difficult stories going back a number of years. For instance, they say the Contra drug stories in the 1980s. And we had, you know, we had a lot of witnesses coming forward and saying they had participated in this operation, or they knew they had firsthand knowledge about this other one, or there were documents about indictments, allegations, sometimes in being done officially in Central America about these kinds of crimes. So it wasn't, so you could piece that together. You could then evaluate the quality of the witnesses. You could examine further whether the court cases were worth something or not that were brought. But there's nothing like that in this case. There are people who speculate that the buildings fell down in a way that they don't think would happen, but other scientists and engineers say yes, they would fall down that way. There was no anomaly in the view of many people who follow this. So
where do these
my problem is you have to give me, or you have to give anyone or someone else, some real evidence, not just that you have speculation. Otherwise, we would spend all our time pursuing things that turn out to be fantasies.
And in terms of where these theories come from, I mean, I assume that those of us who are pretty disgusted with the current government and have seen how they've used 9/11 as a way to help their political careers rather than as a way to protect the American people, are willing to go one step farther and say, as I've seen at least one book, A New Pearl Harbor, that in fact they actually planned this as a way to get America to support Bush.
Right, and obviously the 9/11 situation was exploited for political reasons. There's no question.
No question. And largely they were incompetent in failing to prevent it as well. We know that from, of course, the president's daily brief saying Bin Laden determined to attack the United States. I think
right.
that where it goes one step further is the incompetence before the act and the malice after the act, people assume, becomes malice before the act, and that's the part that still isn't proven.
Right. Well, I mean, what's not proven is that actually something like that happened. I mean, there was clearly incompetence and negligence in the handling of this, of the information. The U.S. intelligence community was not that wrong, and the FBI did have evidence in its files that might have led the attacks to be stopped. But for various reasons, the Bush administration chose to ignore that evidence and even brushed it aside and went ahead with what issues they were more interested in. And then this came back. And then after they failed to stop it, then they used it to justify a whole range of policies that they really wanted to do beforehand, including rolling back civil liberties in the United States, which has been on the shelf for on many, many right-wing think tanks for many, many years. So,
Robert, there was this
exploitation, but that doesn't mean that they planted the bombs or that they did. There's no evidence of that, no real evidence.
Robert, let me go back 40 years, because certainly presidents have been known to do things to get this country into war. One of the most famous, it was the Gulf of Tonkin, where Lyndon Johnson claimed that a ship was blown up, and or even the Maine back in 1898, Spanish-American War, they said the Maine was blown up by the Spanish, turned out to be a boiler accident. I don't know if you know what happened 40 years ago, but maybe you do. How did they find out that actually was not a real incident?
Well, in that case, there was an overinterpretation of what evidence there was. It was an exaggeration of a very confused situation. It's more similar. It's probably more similar to the kinds of the excuses to go to war in Iraq, where sketchy pieces of information were looked at in a way that that the policymakers wanted to. So it was a bit different from what we're talking about, say, with these allegations about blowing up the Twin Towers. It's it was more a case that
manipulating that, the facts around
the facts were manipulated.
People wanted to believe, like they did.
What the policymakers wanted to have happen, so they just took some ambiguous facts and sliced off the parts that were not working their way, and then refined it in a way that made a case for war.
Now let me move, if I can, from left to right, because I'd like to compare these conspiracy theories and know where you think they're similar and where you think they're different. All during the Clinton years, there were people, you know, people like Matt Drudge and Rush Limbaugh and others. They claimed that Bill Clinton actually murdered Vince Foster, accused the president of murder, when, of course, Vince Foster committed suicide and there's no evidence that anything went wrong. Do you see similarities between the right-wing conspiracy theorists, if you will, and those on the left?
I think there, in some of these cases, yes. In the case of course, Vince Foster, it was a fairly clear case of suicide, but a few anomalies were seized on to create more suspicions. Why didn't they find his car keys in his pocket immediately? Why did they found them back at the morgue when they went through his clothes, but they didn't find them when he was at Fort Marcy Park? And then you had also one of my favorite examples of all this was this list that I'd be sent frequently. Then of course it was more faxed than sent emails because we didn't really have those things then. But I would be faxed these lists of mysterious deaths that were somehow linked to Clinton. And I actually spent some time investigating one of them. Some poor fellow who'd been working at the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, had some minor hand in authorizing the Whitewater investigation, and he committed suicide. And I went back and checked through it, and he was a guy who was suffering from AIDS, and he went to a building in Arlington and was taken up to the top floor to look at an apartment, and went to the balcony and turned to the poor woman who was showing in the apartment and said, "Do you think this will hurt?" And he just jumped. Wow. And I actually interviewed the woman and all the rest of it, and I went back to some of these people and I said, "Listen, you know, this was not a case of Bill Clinton. He had nothing to do with this, but whenever I would get that list faxed to me, it would always be on there, because the idea was, if you have enough of these mysterious cases, people will believe, even though there's no evidence of any one of them being true, they'll say, well, there are 40 of them, you know, so one of them must be true. There's sort of an irrational argument that takes place, and I think we've seen some of that on the left as well, that if there are enough anomalies, even though none of them prove anything on their own, look at the whole pile of them together, and you sort of reach a different feeling about it. But that's not really using information well. That's sort of propagandistic.
It's actually something Joe McCarthy did. I did a research paper in college on Joe McCarthy. What he would do is he would give a list of 200 communists in the government, and each and every one of person on that list was flawed. But he'd say, okay, so you found a flaw in 1, 2, or 10, but I have 200 here. And it turns out that every single person on his list was someone who was, you know, well-known or not a communist or dead or all kinds of things. I want to move on to the current situation, the latest conspiracy theory, the one that's just out this week regarding Mark Foley. The Republicans are trying now to turn events on its head and in order to deflect investigation into what they knew about Mark Foley and how he was hitting on pages, blame the Democrats for an October surprise. Are you getting a lot of attention on that?
Well, sure. I'm actually, I was on a right-wing radio show the other day, and I was pounded with that point. And I said to them what I've said to many on the left when they say I should believe that Bush blew up the Twin Towers. I say, well, where's the evidence? I mean, where's the actual evidence? And they didn't really have any, but they just said, well, you know, they mentioned George Soros' name a few times, claiming he was connected to some group that may have, you know, had, you know, something to do with some of the emails, although they couldn't even prove that. But they just threw out a lot of stuff. And I guess if you throw out a lot of stuff and you have a gullible audience, even though there's no real evidence and even though some of it contradicts itself, it's still something that works for people. For instance, in this case, they were also going on about how the Miami Herald many months ago had looked into this and then decided not to do a story. But if the story was being pushed months ago, why would people think that the Democrats were holding it for an October surprise? I mean, it's sort of self-contradictory. But it almost doesn't matter in some of these cases that no matter, even if the evidence sort of itself doesn't fit, they just keep pushing it and saying it, and I guess they feel that enough people will believe them.
Well, the question I have is for people on any political side? Are people just trying to find out the truth? Is how do we know? We spent the first 20 minutes talking about a real problem, Reverend Sun Yang-moon and George H.W. Bush and all of that. And then we talk about some of these other claims, 9/11 or Mark Foley or Vince Foster, and there's no evidence of it. And, you know, I trust you, Robert, but other than knowing sort of who to trust, I mean, people look on the web. There are stories that aren't getting a lot of publicity. One of my favorites that I think is now achieving respectability, though it took us many, many years, is the question of voting machines. I argued back in 2000, 2001 that the voting machines were not reliable, and people said, you know, Mark, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And it took computer scientists and a political movement to basically show that actually that they aren't reliable. But there are other movements. There's movements about Vince Foster. There's movements about 9/11. How can someone trying to, you know, live their lives, but at the same time try to tell the difference between information that's not being reported that's true and information that's not being reported that's false? How can we tell the difference? And before you answer that, I've got to take a break. So I'm going to save that question until after the break. Folks, if you want to call in and add to this discussion, agree or disagree, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, or dial 877-4-HEAD-ON. We'll be right back after this.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at headonradionetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
Headonradionetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at headonradionetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
from Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Well, we all have talk radio. We have people that we trust on the left and the right, and we have people that maybe we shouldn't trust. There are certainly those that listen to Rush Limbaugh. He could tell them 2 plus 2 is 5 and black is white, and they would say ditto, ditto, ditto. There are people on the left that hear theories of 9/11 or other things that really have no evidence to back them up, and they say ditto, 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 because if anything goes wrong, it has to be Bush's fault. And even I'm no friend of the president and can definitely tell you that most of the things this country does wrong are his fault. Can't say that all of them are his fault. So how do we know who's telling the truth? I mean, is it Robert Perry, investigative journalist for Consortium News? Does it just come down to who you trust, or is there a way for people to sort out all these theories, what really has basis in fact, and what is just somebody spouting off?
Well, I think, you know, people should ask the same question I would ask or you would ask in looking into something. You know, what's the evidence? How solid is it? You know, when you read someone's article, if the article is well sourced, well backed up with documents, you know, if you have named people or if you know the person who's writing it, say a Cy Hirsch is a respected journalist and he's vouching for some, you know, military or intelligence source, you probably can count on the fact that he's really got one. He's not just making it up. So I think you have to sort of make those kinds of judgments as you go, but always be skeptical. Always have that grain of salt there to check on a story. But I think a well-informed citizen can look at information and probably be able to discern whether or not there's a lot backing something up, or whether it's someone trying to put together, make a case that doesn't really have a lot there.
But see, I worry that we live in two realities, that we are, you know, two nations. Sometimes, in fact, I think independents complain about both of these nations, and they're in a third nation. But we have a nation where the 33%, I guess, that still approve of George Bush, whatever he says has to be true. He's George Bush. He's the president of the United States. There's no question about whether or not he's telling the truth, just as there are some that will listen on the left and assume that anything anyone on the left says has to be right, no matter how incredulous. And what concerns me is that there's the mainstream media, if you will, is becoming less the media that checks out stories and more the media that's reporting the biases of the left or the right. One of the things, for example, that I tried a lot to work on before it came out a little bit in the press is George Bush going AWOL, and I found the original documents to show that he was ordered to be in Alabama in a specific place and time. I found the actual order, which I put on my website, and still the main story was Dan Rather got some facts wrong, so I guess George Bush wasn't AWOL. How do we get out of this, well, the media saying, hey, this is from the left, this is from the right, we can't trust it, and actually use facts to prove a case?
Well, that's a good question. I think, having been in the mainstream media, what happened, and it was a particularly strong movement that began mostly from the right in the late 70s and through the 80s, was to politicize the news media, to attack journalists, to go after them individually, try to discredit them. So if a reporter was bringing forward information, you would try to discredit the reporter. You'd try to get him reassigned, try to get him fired. There was something called the public diplomacy team that the Reagan administration put together. They also called it perception management. And the idea was, if you could shape the information and control the information getting to the American people, you could control their perceptions. And the key to that was to control what the National Press Corps was able to write. And so you had reporters who were doing honest work in difficult situations often being discredited and destroyed. And there were private organizations like Accuracy and Media that would join in and work hand in glove with the White House. So it got pretty ugly, and it hasn't changed. In part, what's happened is that the press in Washington has kind of internalized that pressure, so people anticipate it, and they don't want that to happen to them. They don't want their careers to be damaged, so they get snide toward some kinds of information, or they ignore other kinds of information because they know it's going to bring them more grief than it's worth.
I think that's
a great tragedy.
Is the example of Dan Rather, I mean, is that an example that's going to go down for decades as a be careful what you print? And I mean, because the story that Dan Rather did, my understanding of it, is that basically he got the story right, but the documents that he used to prove the story were false documents, and that was wrong.
No, that's not even true. I mean, the documents were not false documents, but they had not ascertained that they were real documents. No one's proven that those documents were fabrications or somehow taken from the composites, if you will. The information in them was accurate. They had that confirmed elsewhere.
The secretary confirmed it.
The secretary who was involved with that officer in the military confirmed it. But the investigation that was done by Thornburg and Bacardi for CBS concluded that there was no evidence that these were falsified, but that that there hadn't been enough care taken in validating the documents. So, and that became the basis for, I think it was four producers to be fired.
I mean,
these are people with long careers.
I mean,
and
here's
then Dan
a guy,
Rather was forced out.
I mean, he's been there on the set for, what, 25 years, something like that? I mean, you know, the big three, him, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, I guess there's, you know, they're different ones now. But this is a fixture in American politics. This isn't just some reporter. This is one of the most well-known reporters in America. How do you think what happened to Dan Rather will inhibit, I guess, press coverage in the future? Are people now scared?
Sure. And I think you've seen that with CBS and the way they've gone more recently, almost avoiding news and certainly avoiding anything that might get them in the crosshairs again. So, sure, I mean that those sorts of things are object lessons for other journalists. If you're a journalist, you're probably most people aren't rich; they don't have like a trust fund to fall back on. They're working stiffs. And they make decent money, but often not great money. And if they end up losing their careers or their jobs, they won't be able to pay their mortgage. They won't be able to put their kids through college. They won't be able to retire. So it's a very frightening thing for journalists. And when they see how easy it is, especially for the right, to take people out, and the left really doesn't have that kind of power. But
well, I was going to ask you
the
about
right
that.
Does.
I mean, when you look at, for example, the Foley matter, I mean, it's a great example here now. The Miami Herald had information back in May. They didn't report it, possibly because they were scared of a response like the one that happened to Dan Rather. And then it doesn't come out to October, and then the right complains about that. Do you think there's an asymmetry here? Do you think that the left can't force out a Tony Snow or whoever the way that the right has power, and if so, why?
Well, the basically what happened is that that after Watergate and after the Vietnam defeat in the 1970s, and also after the Civil Rights Movement, the conservatives, the right in America, they were very hateful and angry about the media and what it had done or what they thought it had done, and they began building their own. And they began building pressure groups. They brought together, foundations. Richard Mellon Scaife was part of that, but Bill Simon, who was head of the Olin Foundation, was sort of the lead figure. And they got people like Reverend Moon with hundreds of millions of dollars to come in and start building this infrastructure. So they built a very powerful, dedicated, conservative media, and they would call the mainstream media liberal, which it really wasn't. I worked in it. I mean, there were a lot of my senior editors were basically very pro-Reagan. They were not at all liberals. So there was an imbalance that was created. There was huge pressure from the right. There was a mainstream press which had a lot of people who sympathized strongly with conservative positions in it. And there was not much pressure from the left because the left was not focused on media and still isn't. The left has focused more on grassroots organizing, things of that sort. So
you think there's more today, though? I mean, there is some liberal talk radio. It's new. Well, I admit it. I've been on the air 3 years. We're still pretty small. There are media watchdog organizations on the left, some sponsored by George Soros, to throw out the name you threw out earlier. Is the left coming back now and pushing it towards center, or do we still have a long way to go?
Well, the left has a long way to go. I mean, it's true that Air America got started, I think, in 2004, but they were so far behind the curve, and they're, as you know, they're barely hanging on. There was rumors about them going into bankruptcy. So it's not like the right, which has had well-funded operations. A lot of them were funded through nonprofits, but that was sort of to prime the pump. Now you have actually conservative media outlets that make money.
Fox News, of course. Right.
You've got Limbaugh. You've got people that can actually are now making money either through books or through their own programs, whereas you don't really have that on the left. You don't have that
Why
kind of
not?
Infrastructure.
Why
well,
not?
Because
what would it take?
Well, I think you'd have to have a lot more focus from wealthy liberals in supporting and building this kind of infrastructure. I was at a speech the other day by Ted Turner, and one of the questions he was asked was whether he would consider sort of starting a new kind of CNN, you know, which because he's very disgusted with what's happened with CNN since it was taken away from him by Time Warner. And he said no, he doesn't want to deal with that anymore. So you have the people that might have the means and actually the experience who, for various reasons, don't want to do it. And there's been a general feeling on the American left, I guess dating back to probably to the 20s or whatever, that the real key to responding is to do grassroots organizing, you know, and that's sort of where they put their dough. Where the right is much more willing to put money into media and understanding the power of that, especially in a modern-day America, the left has been very, very slow, almost like there's a dogma that exists on the left against doing that. So if that's the way it remains, I don't know how you solve the problem. There really has to be some counterbalance, as you suggested. There has to be, well, I prefer, you know, I'm a mainstream journalist. I prefer that kind of, a, you know, just honest, independent journalism. There probably does have to be some more weight on the left in terms of media to counterbalance what's on the right.
And what you find, it's really weird. You have the Fox Propaganda Channel, which is owned, you know, an owned subsidiary of the Republican Party. They claim to be fair and balanced, and they claim that the media in the middle is on the left. And it, what's interesting is you have sort of, it's disingenuous. You have, at least on the left, the organizations sort of admit, yes, you know, we are progressive organizations. On the right, they won't even admit that. And I wonder if it's sort of just a basic dishonesty that's a difference between the right and the left. One of the things that you mentioned on Consortium News is this sort of power of the right to retaliate. You mentioned in regard to the Capitol Hill pages, but really could go well up and down. I mean, you look at a guy like Richard Clark, who is this, you know, worked for Reagan, worked for Bush, worked for Clinton too, certainly a conservative by any normal stretch of the word, and he just gets trashed when he comes out and complains about the president. But on the left, when people complain about Bill Clinton or whatever, a lot of times I guess they're supported. Did you find there's a difference, that there's a more monolithic or more retaliatory on the right and more freedom of speech differences on the left?
Well, I'm not gonna make those kind of broad sweeping statements about people on the left or right, but I do think that the machinery that we have on the right in the United States is very well organized, very well funded, and takes a kind of anyone who gets in our way is going to be taken down. That's sort of the approach. These are the professional people on the right, I would say. These are the real operatives. Whether they're called OPPO people, well, there yeah, people like Karl Rove, they have a whole industry in Washington called OPPO, or opposition research,
people
to dig up dirt on people and or take it out of context and throw it at them. But that's been applied not just to politicians, but as I said, to journalists and also to people like a Richard Clark, who comes out and says, "Hold it, this is what happened," and he tells the truth, and they quibble with him and they try to take things and call him a liar, and they go on the floor of the Senate with statements, and they and the same happened to
Paul O'Neill,
even to Paul O'Neill, right, who was the Treasury Secretary, and so it happened, or to Joe Wilson when he came out and correctly said that there was that the intelligence on the yellow cake in Niger was being twisted, and he's still being trashed years later.
I'm trying to compare it to
Lawrence Walsh. It happens to almost anybody, even
I'm
if you're a Republican.
On the left side, and I'm trying to think of an example, and maybe, you know, Joe Lieberman certainly has been, you know, criticized on his left, but it's not so much they're trashing him as they're criticizing him for his policies. They don't like that he's standing with Bush, but you don't see the kind of, I don't know, aggressive personal attacks from the left on people, on apostates, if you will, traitors to the cause, that you do on the right. Is that fair?
Well, I think I've heard, I'm afraid, for instance, on the Foley matter, I probably have heard a little bit of a glee in the voices of some of the folks like on Air America and so forth that troubles me. I don't really like that. I don't think people should to take pleasure in someone having that kind of a, you know, situation. And so I do think that is creeping in, and I think it may creep in part as reaction to the years and years of how effective it's been on the right, but I still, as an American citizen and as a journalist, I don't like it.
I also fear that it turns off those in the middle that are just trying to find out the truth and not adhere to a certain left or right cause. Robert Perry, this hour's gone very quick. I really appreciate this conversation. I think my listeners have learned a lot. Thank you very much for coming on the
Inside Scoop. Well, you're very welcome. Thanks.
That's it for the Inside Scoop today. Tune in tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Mark Levine signing off.
Talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now,